It's been a while since we've been in the geography book. We've been doing a lot of really good studies, and I was out, and then holidays and things, and then sick and different things. But we should be on the period of the early judges. And if you remember, before the world began, God had a great plan. He started telling the plan to the first fathers and picked one first father, Abraham, and gave him three promises. I'm going to make you a big family, and he did that. And I'm going to give you a special land to live in. And he just did that. And through your seed is going to come a great blessing for everybody, which we'll talk about in the New Testament. But there was the problem that they weren't in their special land. They were slaves in Egypt. So God sent him a hero named Moses to get him out of Egypt and all the way through down to the Mount Sinai, and then up on the way to the promised land, and then sent the spies in. Spies came back and said, 10 of them said, oh, we can't do this. There's giants in the land. We just can't do this. And two faithful spies, Joshua and Caleb, said, yes, we can. Let's go take the land God told us that he's giving us. But because of that, they had to wander around in the wilderness for 40 years. One year for every day that they spied out the land. So God sends them another hero named Joshua to enter into the land at the Battle of Jericho. Why couldn't Moses go in? He disobeyed, struck the rock instead of speaking to the rock, and he took credit for it. He took all the credit for it. How many times must we provide this water for you? I'm sorry. I don't care how many times Moses hit that rock. He could have had some kind of chisel and chiseled and chiseled and chiseled. It was not going to provide water for those people without God's power. And God, I mean, think about how much water that had to be. We've talked about it before. There was over a million people. That's a lot of water. Okay? And it wasn't just a one-time thing. They had to have daily water. And so it provided a lot of water for them.
Especially if they took a bath, huh?
Right.
They've been wandering a long time.
But God took care of them, got them into the promised land at the Battle of Jericho, and then they went on this series of battles where they were to take over the land and drive out the Canaanites from the land. And they did that for the most part, and we'll talk a little bit about it in a minute, but then we reach the time period of Judges, because they don't drive out everybody, as we're going to see in this lesson. They become friendly with them. They start worshiping their gods. And when they turn away from God and serve these other gods, God allows an enemy nation to come up against them and oppress them.
You know, that really took a lot of faith on the part of the people.
Sure.
Do we have that measure of faith? I like to think of that sometimes.
To
boost my faith.
You know, I saw several little things in here that made me think, okay, we don't have to fight the Philistines. Okay? We don't have the Amalekites coming after us and the Midianites. We don't have all that. But do we get bogged down with the little and little?
And you know what makes you strong? It's when you have to push against something.
Mm-hmm.
If you never use your arm, you wouldn't have any strength in it.
That's right.
So it boosts our faith if we have to push.
And it's a continuous thing, because even if you've built up some strong muscles and then you don't do anything for a while, they atrophy.
Yes.
And stuff. Lauren?
I was going to say that this makes me think of the modern times, is we're so busy befriending people instead of hating what... We're supposed to hate the sin.
Right.
Love the people, but you still need... And we try to, as you said, respect everybody's feelings and get it all in. And we should still hate that. It's still wrong. We should definitely abolish that part of it.
Right.
And we don't.
That's a hard part.
It's a very hard part, because we're supposed to love the sinner. We're supposed to love our enemies. But there's a line that we have to draw. I think sometimes we blur that line. And we become friendly with the world. We erase the line. You're right. We pretend it never was there because God... And we justify it because God wants us to love the sinner.
You know, the part I hate about myself is I know a lot of this stuff, but how much am I practicing that?
That's right.
The application is what we really do.
Exactly. And
I'm talking too much.
No, 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 you're fine. You're fine. But what we're going to talk about today, the little and little is what got them. And I think that happens to us too. Because how many of you, I mean, and I'll just kind of throw this out there because I don't think that anybody in the room has done this. How many of you have committed murder? Yeah. I
just thought of it.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
But I mean, we don't have that. How many of you have extorted money from some big, I mean, company or something that you work with? Or a little amount or something. I mean, how many of you have done that? No? But how many of us have maybe gossiped or lied or been proud?
Do you know, define gossip to it. Some of us think if we tell something that's the truth, it's okay. But sometimes that's not
good. Sometimes that's not good either.
Better just left alone.
Right. I was always taught, and I didn't always practice it, that you don't have to tell everything that you know. And sometimes we do it, and we think that we're doing the right thing. We think that we're doing it because we're trying to help the person or something, but really we're just spreading the news that we have. You know, I mean, and that's one of our little and littles that get us. Or maybe there's the verse that talks about, to him that knows to do good and doeth it not, to him it is sin. Maybe our little and little is because we get so busy with things that aren't sinful necessarily, but just take up so much of our time that we aren't doing the things that we should be doing. You know, we don't have trouble with the, you know, we don't smoke, we don't drink, we don't, you know, and we don't do this and we don't do that. But what about the things that we're supposed to be doing? Maybe that's our little and little.
Could I brag on the congregation?
Sure.
Just a little bit. I was a little bit sick a while ago. Not sick enough to be treated so nicely. But man, I tried to prolong that as long as we ate so well and we had so much this, so much of this.
Yes.
So, but I would like to brag on us.
Well, and that's important. That's important. It is. Okay, so the early judges, and we find this, of course, in the book of Judges. That makes sense for if you are thinking about where to find it. This all happened about 1,300 years, or 13 to 1,400 years before Christ was born. And I know I told it to do this, but...
pushed it all the way in for me.
See, this is why the ignorance is bliss part.
What you need is your daughter.
I know. Okay.
There you go.
We'll see if that works now. Okay. We have covered the Old Testament, the books of law, Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy. We've gone into the books of history, Joshua and Judges, and now here we are. This time period takes about 300 years to go through. All right. You have Othniel, Ehud, Shamgar, Deborah, Gideon, Abimelech, Tola, Jair, Zephthah, Ibzan, Elon, Abdon, Samson, and the last two judges, Eli and Samuel.
Abimelech was not a judge.
Yeah, well, yeah. But they put him in the list.
They should.
Right.
I will not teach kids that Abimelech was a judge. And I teach them to speak out when somebody calls Abimelech a judge. He wasn't. He was a takeover king.
Yes. Yes. I think they put him in there because he's in the time period of Judges and he's listed with the judges and he's the son of.
Yeah, he's the son of a judge and that's why they went ahead and told the story. Plus the fact that if you want to think of it that way, he was the first king of Israel.
Self-appointed king. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Okay. So, the Israelites have possessed the land of Canaan under the leadership of Joshua, and they had good intentions of being faithful. Remember at the end of Joshua when he tells them, if it seems evil for you this day to serve God, choose for yourselves this day whom you will serve, whether the gods of your fathers on the other side of the river or the gods of the Amorites in whose land you now dwell, but as for me and my house, we will serve the Lord. And what did they say? We want to serve God. Yes, yes, us too. Us too. That's what we want to do. You know, get us one of those plaques to put up in our kitchen. You know, that's we'll do it too. And he said, don't say it if you don't mean it. He said, because if you say you're going to serve God and then you turn away from God, he will turn from you and do you harm. But they said, no, but we will serve the Lord. And they did. They served God pretty faithfully all the rest of the days of Joshua and the elders who outlived Joshua. But then there arose this generation who knew not God, and they had not done what was right. Okay? All right, let's look in the book itself. It's got, okay, for the first time, I'll read the first part of it. For the first time, the Israelites had a homeland. Each tribe had its own territory. They got to pick their territories. Each family within each tribe soon had its own plot of ground to farm or use however it chose. This was a great day in their history. They've gotten their land. They're exactly where God wants them to be. The story doesn't end here, however. This was a good generation of people in many ways. They had seen many of the miracles that had occurred during the wandering in the wilderness. They had crossed the Jordan on dry land with Joshua. These were not the ones who had murmured and rebelled against God because all those died in the wilderness. They had served as a courageous soldiers under the leadership of Joshua. And the author says, I believe, and I do too, that they intended to serve God all their lives. But humanity fails. Okay? Moses told them, when the Lord thy God shall bring thee into the land, whither thou goest to possess it, and hast cast out many nations before thee, thou shalt smite them and utterly destroy them. Thou shalt make no covenant with them, nor show mercy unto them. Okay, what about making friends with them? I think that's probably right there. Showing mercy to them, that would be not. Neither shalt thou make marriages with them, for they will turn away thy son from following me, that they may serve other gods. So will the anger of the Lord be kindled against you and destroy them suddenly, or destroy thee suddenly. Moreover, the Lord thy God will send the hornet among them, until they that are left and hide themselves from thee be destroyed. Thou shalt not be affrighted of them, and the Lord thy God will put out those nations before thee by little and little. Thou mayest not consume them at once, lest the beast of the field increase upon thee. But the Lord thy God shall deliver them unto thee, and shall destroy them with a mighty destruction until they be destroyed. That's in Deuteronomy 7. So he says, we're not going to wipe them totally. We've wiped out the majority of them, but we're not going to wipe out all of them. Why? Okay. Well, it says, lest the beast of the field increase. I mean, so you've got all these people, they would be killing animals. And if they weren't there to kill the animals, what could the animals do? I mean, they're wild animals. They could multiply a lot quicker and be a problem for the Israelites. Okay, so he's going to let the rest of them be there for a while until they can spread through the land and increase their number. And then we're going to wipe them out little by little. But we made friends with them. Okay, the first part of the commandment was carried out in Joshua's day. Joshua 11:15 says that Joshua did all that the Lord had commanded. They entered the land and conquered every army that opposed them, but it was the remaining little and little that caused them to stumble. Okay, Joshua called the people together before his death and warned them of the dire consequences if they failed to finish the task before them. Patsy, do you want to read? That's quite. Laura, we'll start at the back and come forward then.
Ye have seen all that the Lord your God hath done unto all these nations because of you. For the Lord your God is he that hath fought for you. Behold, I have divided unto you by lot these nations that remain to be an inheritance for your tribes.
and the Lord your God, he shall expel them from before you and drive them out of your sight. And ye shall possess their land, as the Lord your God hath promised unto you. Be ye therefore very courageous to keep and do all that is written in the book of the law of Moses, that ye come not among these nations, these that remain among you. Else if ye do in any wise go back, and cleave unto the remnant of these nations, and shall make marriages with them, and go in unto them, and they to you. Know for a certainty that the Lord your God will no more drive out any of these nations from before you, but they shall be snares and traps unto you, and scourges unto your sides, and thorns into your eyes, until ye perish from off this good land which the Lord your God hath given you. Powerful.
Very powerful. But it has meaning to us too, because there's a verse in the Bible, in the New Testament, that says, I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me. So I become a Christian, and there's some things that I need to put out of my life. And with God's help, I can do that. But if I insist on keeping them around for a little while, does there reach a point where God isn't helping us unless we turn back to him? I mean, he's always ready to help us.
He's got to see us doing our part.
We have to do our part. He's not going to just all of a sudden put this big hedge about you that no sin, no temptation is going to touch you. He gives you the way out. He's going to help you find the way out and take that way out. But if we insist on being friendly with the world, we're enmity with God.
I saw on a marquee one time, and I've never forgotten it, it said, when you're fleeing from sin, don't leave a forwarding address. And it's a comical thing, but it's very true. We shouldn't play with it. We should run with everything that we have from it.
You're right. Anybody else have a comment about that? Because, I mean, I think that affects us. You know, we have to remember that the Old Testament was written for our learning. It wasn't just written for us to know the history of the people. That helps, because then we see how God was able to do all these things and take care of them, and then we can trust him to take care of us. And we see the plan of God in action. Yes, that's true. But we should be able to find some things that apply to us instead of just saying, well, oh, these people in the judges' time period, oh, they were bad. You know, we're good, they're bad. We find ourselves in plenty of pickles just like they did. And unfortunately, sometimes, and I've been guilty of it too, that we kind of feel like we have our ticket punched to heaven. And so, you know, we're going to be okay no matter what. I mean, we do have the hope and the comfort that we get from knowing that as we turn back to God, he's always there to forgive us. But we need to not be friendly with the world.
Well, in this example, when you were talking about Moses, look at Moses, what he did. I mean, and what a great example of a good person in that way or whatever. But he got comfortable, a little bit comfortable, and he was punished for it.
Yes.
And I'm nowhere near, I don't think.
Yeah. I'm nowhere near the meekest man.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. No, I'm not.
Can we sin knowingly and just think, well, God's going to forgive me?
No. If we do,
you're missing the boat.
Yeah, we're.
And we sin willfully, there remaineth no more. I can't remember my
story. No more sacrifice. No more sacrifice. And we have to be aware that if we sin that way, there's not any other plan that God's got for us. This is it. And if we sin that way, we risk hardening our hearts to where we aren't willing to see the error of our way and turn back.
In fact, you can't say, well, I'll sin today at night in my prayer and I'll ask forgiveness and it'll happen.
No, I mean, that was a big thing in the early Catholic Church, buying indulgences, where they paid ahead for the sin that they were about to go out and commit. They, yeah, I don't know that they call it that anymore, but
my whole family is Catholic. They still, but it's not quite labeled the same way, but it's there.
Right. Well, and I can remember we went to a little garage sale one time back years ago when we had first moved to Lake Charles, and it was out in the country, and we're out there, and this Steve's, he's good about giving out a pamphlet or a sermon outline or anything. And this guy goes, "Oh, well, yeah." He said, "I've already donated a bunch of money to such and such church, and they've built a wing, you know, with the money that I've donated." So and he literally said, "I have my ticket stamped to heaven." And, you know,
chapter and verse.
Yeah. Right. It was almost so blasphemous. Well, it was. That you almost felt like you needed to step back because something's fixing to happen. But literally, he truly felt that way. That he had donated enough money to a religious thing that he has a mansion waiting on him in heaven. Yes.
In the Deuteronomy reading this morning, we think we can dabble in the world and get away with it, and we've still got it all together up here. But you mm-hmm. notice he said, "And they will turn away your son."
Mm-hmm.
Our children see this example, and then they could carry it other and get lost out there.
Right.
So it's, you have to be very careful.
Right. I know that there are people who've married non-Christians and been successful in converting them. And that's, I thank God that they were able to do that. Because there are some wonderful members of the church that wouldn't have been there had they not had that person in their life to inspire them and teach them the truth. But one of the things that I always tried to impress upon my child on whether or not to who to marry was you can't count on converting them. And if you don't, or if it takes you years and years and years and years to do it, what happens to your children? Because they might be lost because of and we have a dear friend that this happened to, and Terry obeyed the gospel. We knew him back in Lake Charles. That about the time we moved to Brenham, they moved up back to his home place up in northeast Texas. And years went by. They had been married probably 30 years, and Terry obeyed the gospel. And we were thrilled. And we've gone and visited them several times. And a more humble man I don't think you would meet, and a more zealous person. He's gone back and he's tried to all his friends and all his family that he influenced the wrong way before, and he was always a good man. He was like a Cornelius to me. He's always gone back, but what trouble, and every time we talk to him, first thing on his mind is, "My children are lost because I took so long to be willing to go against my family in the Baptist church, and my children are lost."
I'm talking too much, I know, but we had a friend kind of like that. We were very close. I was close with his wife for a long time, and then her husband and mine became friends, and he was not a Christian. He never tried in any way to keep her from living a Christian life.
Mm-hmm.
We couldn't interest him. But long towards the end of his life, he became a Christian. And we could hardly get him out of the
right.
door to go
right.
on.
Right.
He enjoyed being a Christian mm-hmm. more than anybody I nearly ever knew.
Yeah.
It was Ellen Hall, I think somebody here might remember him.
Yeah.
He was a zealous Christian.
But I think
and
that
he grieved about the years that he was. Mm-hmm.
Miss Tippy, that is your 10:45 warning. Do you want to come out this way?
I can walk out this way.
Oh, it doesn't matter. But I think that's a very important, and I meant to hone in on that. They'll pull your sons away. And so even if you're strong enough to withstand it and have worldly friends and somehow you're able to withstand it, is your spouse going to be strong enough to withstand it? Are your children going to be strong enough to withstand it?
More likely not.
More likely not. And it's sad, and that's something that a lot of people have to face at the end of their life, the guilt.
I think everybody here would think my dad was very, very hard. But he told me, I will disown you if you marry out of the church.
Wow.
And yeah. He put the fear in me.
Yeah.
And I'm grateful for that.
Well.
Because I see too many people that are close to me mm-hmm. that they come to church alone. And yeah. they've had to try to bring their children alone.
Yeah.
And
It's a harder life.
Difficult life.
It's much harder. Now, being married to a Christian isn't all.
No.
I mean, there's still.
And it can end too.
It could end too, but it's if we could just teach our young, the next generation, the importance of how important who they marry is.
I've got three children that have married people that were not brought up in the church,
mm-hmm.
and they are not like they should be.
Right. These people were warned, and we need to do a little bit more warning. I think
it's a fight
yes.
every day.
Yes,
it's
it is.
It's a struggle every day. You never can let your guard down.
That's right. Otherwise, we're not taking care of the little and little.
I think I thought maybe that they got that by osmosis.
I think I did too.
Yeah.
I mean, because if we went to church all the time, we did everything.
Right.
We assumed.
Yes.
That's right.
We did. And they were fine when they were home.
Right. And what happened to this generation and the judges? There arose a generation who knew not God. How did they not know God? Their parents didn't teach it to them.
As a parent, that's one of the hardest things. It's a thought every day with me. What can I say? What can I do?
Right. Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah.
But sometimes when I was kind of thinking about that and everything, I had someone tell me that said, "What do you think? How do you think God feels?"
That's right.
All of his people, I mean,
we've all at one time turned away from him.
Yeah. You read about those in the Bible. The man's faithful, but his sons are
here
in Judges.
Yeah. Oh, yes. Okay. If the Israelites had listened to the warnings and had destroyed the rest of the Canaanites, their entire remaining history might have been different. Instead, time passed and very few additional Canaanites were destroyed. The various tribes felt distressed that there were still Canaanites within their borders. The tribes of Manasseh and Ephraim complained to Joshua about those within their territories. He told them to join forces and destroy the enemies, but they didn't. And that's in Joshua 17:12-18. The tribes of Judah and Simeon did join forces and made some raids, and they were quite successful, but they stopped before attacking the most powerful cities in Judges chapter 1:1-20. The typical Israelite family no doubt felt some distress over the remaining Canaanites, but the family itself was comfortable in its own farm. Months and then years passed with very few efforts to destroy the Canaanite neighbors with their idols. Gradually, Israelite families made friends with the Canaanite families nearby. The Israelites first tolerated their neighbors' idolatrous worship of Baal and then began experimenting with the idols themselves. Thought that was my thing going off again. I was thinking it was. Maybe it is.
Does that not make you think of almost like that? How we have it.
I just saw a t-shirt that one of my cousins had posted on on Facebook, and it was talking about loving the sinner and stuff, and that we're supposed to love our Muslim sinners, we're supposed to love our this sinner, this our gay sinner, you know, not, and they, it didn't use the, no, it's it, not our neighbors, our Muslim neighbors, our this neighbors, our gay neighbors, our this neighbors, our atheist neighbors, and it just had a whole list of things that, generally speaking, you know, half of them were sinful things, and I thought,
but hate the sin.
Yeah, and there was, they left that totally out. We're supposed to love them. Well, loving them is going to love them enough to tell them the truth about, I mean, because you can love, I mean, in a very crude way, you can love them right into hell. I mean, if you don't ever, you might be the only person in their life who knows about God, the true God, and what it takes to serve Him. And if we just, oh, I love you, and you know, you're a little bit different than me, but you know, you have your rights too, and never say anything to them, you can love them.
It's really no different than if you had a big pool full of sharks, and you, somebody said, I want to swim with those sharks. You know what's going to happen. But you said, okay, fine. If that's how you want to be, I respect your right. Go ahead, jump it.
Yeah.
You know what's going to happen. You would never let that person do that.
Mm-mm.
And you know what's going to happen with those sins. Yeah. There's no doubt about it. We know that it's wrong. You still love that person, but mm-hmm. you're not going to let them willfully harm themselves.
Right. Right. But what happened with these families? They made friends with them, and then they started dabbling in the idolatry. One of the verses that we read last week was how that covetousness is idolatry. So we don't have to have a fancy little golden calf or a wooden statue or a bronze something or anything else. We can just have the love of money. We can just have the love of things and the desire. Rick preached on Sunday, and one of the phrases he used in there, and he did it accidentally because I asked him later on. He said the desire to acquire, and I said, you know, that makes sense. The desire to acquire, and when we have that, then we're missing the boat. We're letting that come between us and God. We're putting it above God. Gradually all battle stopped, and God was angry with the people because they had not obeyed Him. The day came when He told them He would no longer help drive out the remaining people. They would be left to prove Israel, to see if they would be faithful in spite of the idolatrous worship of their surrounding neighbors. Israel failed the test innumerable times as the years went by. For the next long period of history, the Israelites lived in their tribal territories with no central government in the land. God was their king. If they served God faithfully, all was well. If they turned to the idols of the Canaanites, God would allow an enemy to oppress them. And when they cried to God for help, He would raise up a judge to deliver them to fight against the enemy. Over and over, the cycle went. Okay. Now, I'm going to let y'all make the decision, because I'm good either way. It's 10:54, so do y'all want to go a little bit further since we got a late start, or you have to leave at 11? Okay. Well, I tell you what, we'll maybe get just the first couple of paragraphs in, and then we'll continue on there after next week. Or I'm assuming that Jean will want us to go ahead and finish out this lesson, but we'll tell her we're going to do that. Okay, so the first oppression came of this time period came from outside the borders of Canaan. Cushan Rishathaim, and it means doubly wicked of Canaan, or doubly wicked Cushan. Okay, and where were they from? Mesopotamia. And as soon as I did that, I won't worry about that. Okay, they came from Mesopotamia. Mesopotamia, remember, is that area over there between the Euphrates and the Tigris River. So if Canaan's here, and the Sea of Galilee, Jordan River, and the Dead Sea, and you pass over all that wilderness, the Arabian Desert, and you get over here to the E and the T, the Euphrates and the Tigris River, and that Fertile Crescent, Fertile Crescent is the Mesopotamia area. Okay. And they oppressed Israel for 8 years. Naturally, the kingdoms of Mesopotamia would be concerned over who owned the little land because their trade routes passed through there. God helped Othniel throw off the oppression, but we don't have any record of the battle details. Okay. All right, and then what's the next one? In chapter 3, verse 12 and 13, who were the three groups that came up against Israel, joined forces? The Moabites, the Ammonites, and the Amalekites. Okay. And they joined forces and oppressed Israel for 18 years. And remember that we've talked about where Moab's location is. It's between the Zered and Arnon rivers. And if you remember the rivers on the eastern side of the Jordan River, I call it Y-Jazz. You've got the one that starts with a Y and then J-A-Z. So it's between the two bottom rivers, the A and the Z. Okay, let me see if I can get that up there without knocking the book over. No, it's not. It's just not letting us do this. Oh, it's not even showing. Let's see if it changes that. It's not. It's showing it right on mine. Sorry. Faith will fix that next time. But it's between the two bottom rivers are the Moabites. Okay? And yes, if you go to page 78, between the bottom two rivers at the base of the Dead Sea, the bottom half of the Dead Sea is Moab. Ammon is just to the right side of the Jordan River, past the land of Gad and Reuben. And then the Amalekites, who are they? They're a nomadic tribe. And so we first found them over in Egypt. I think that, yeah. When they went against the Israelites right after they came out of crossed the Red Sea and they're on their way to Mount Sinai and they have the battle there. Yeah, later on, Saul's going to be given an order to destroy all the Amalekites. But so they first attacked Israel at Rephidim in the southern part of the Sinai Peninsula. And now here they're on the eastern side of the Jordan joining forces against the Israelites. The combined forces succeeded in crossing the Jordan and taking the city of what?
Palms.
The city of palm trees or palms. Same thing as Jericho. Yeah. And then you have Ehud, who's one of the judges. He killed Eglon, the king of Moab, and fled to Sarah in the hill country of Ephraim. Okay. And he sounded a trumpet, and the children of Israel rallied round him. They took the blank of the blank, the fords of the Jordan, and killed
10,000
Moabite men, probably. So they killed 10,000 the Moabite men who were trying to return home. And remember, they would be going from Jordan. They would have tried to cross there at at the river and the fords, and then they would have tried to get on the eastern side so that they could go south and get home. And Israel was victorious, and the land was at rest for 80 years. Okay, so that's where we'll stop with them at rest. We don't want to leave them in the middle of a battle. And we'll pick up there next week.